Hi, this is Janelle Engelstad, and welcome to the MAP Radio Hour podcast, produced by Make Art with Purpose. The MAP Radio Hour features conversations with people addressing issues at the intersection of art, society, the environment, and culture. You can find out more about MAP and our projects at makeartwithpurpose.net. This episode of the MAP Radio Hour features Elizabeth Manoyan and Robert Ferry, the founding co-directors of Land Art Generator, an organization and international sustainable design event with the goal of accelerating the transition to post-carbon economies by providing models of renewable energy infrastructure that inspires, educates, and adds value to public space. During this time, it's interesting when I talk with folks to say, so how are you doing? How's lockdown going? What's happening with you guys in terms of, are things shifting? Have they shifted? And are new things coming out of this time that might not have happened had we not had this virus?
It's a great question. And the first answer is we're doing well. You know, we're safe and healthy and enjoying the nature of the Pacific Northwest during all of this lockdown. So that we're grateful for. And yes, we've had to shift our programming, not the overall, like the large scale design competitions, but the educational programming that we typically do one-on-one in person for duration has had to shut down, obviously. So for example, in April, we were scheduled to be in Gerlach, Nevada with K-12 students for a full month of STEAM programming that we were going to conduct. And there was going to be a solar mural outcome designed by the students and then installed on the school. So we had to shift gears immediately, which is very unfortunate because that would have been strong programming. But instead, we've been working with a group called Tunnel Monster Collective to develop a board game that's about resource management. So it's been an interesting shift, and the outcome will be quite strong.
You have prototypes that are really new innovations. How much do you see the role of policy in this work you're doing? And is that a next step? Is that already happening? Because I think that a lot of what has been proposed through Land Art Generator absolutely is policy or needs to connect to policy.
Very, very true. We're glad that you make that connection. It's something that is very important to the work that we do. As you know, making art with purpose, art has a profound power to influence culture, and the result of that oftentimes becomes policy. We like to look back at the other eras of the United States history, particularly the Works Progress Administration and the New Deal era, as a time when artists were engaged very actively in deployment of infrastructure. And we would love to see that be the case in the Green New Deal version, the 21st century's infrastructure deployment, because we're going to be, whether we intend to or not, creating new landmarks for the future, places that live on today, like the Hoover Dam, and get tourists to fly in on helicopters from Las Vegas to see the beautiful Art Deco architecture and artwork set in that beautiful landscape. And they may leave not even knowing if it's a hydroelectric dam because they're so overwhelmed by the beauty of the architecture and the art. And there will be places that are built in the next decade that will have that same kind of function for future generations to reflect on this important time in our history when we made the transition, when we electrified everything, when we stopped burning carbon-based fuels. So we feel very strongly that that's important. And some of the policy ideas that, we try to promote have to do with 1% for the arts for energy projects, a reinforcement of the energy cooperative as a mechanism for deploying distributed energy resources in cities that can be done in a way that's equitable and build wealth for communities that historically have been not party to that opportunity. So yes, short answer, policy is fundamental to everything that we think about. And we can't as creatives ignore policy. We have to be at the table designing that policy.
And when he says we need to be at the table, I would like to include that that is what is so important here, is whose voices are at the table. And in that policy, there has to be space for communities to be at the table to discuss the energy landscapes that are coming into their communities and their neighborhoods and on their block. And how can they have input? How can they have design input? And how can they have the proper education so that as these installations move through time, they have the capacity to maintain those systems as they need to? You know, case study after case study shows that if community has not been involved, there will be pushback on an installation.
Yeah, human-centered design. So can you talk about that a little more? I mean, how have Indigenous communities been a part of what you do, or, you know, BIPOC communities? Have they so far been a part of your team? Are they part of your advisory board? You know, are they already in your system?
Well, Lahi 2020 Fly Ranch is a great example. We have others, but I'll start there because it's our most current project that we're working on. It was a design challenge for Fly Ranch, which is 3,800 acres owned by Burning Man in the Nevada desert. And it is traditionally Paiute land. So we can tell you that on our juror list, our shortlisting committee, and our technical advisors, we have strong representation of the Paiute, as well as other nations in the area. So that decisions that are made are first through that lens.
That's great.
We started in 2018 and we were working in Melbourne, Australia, where the term of art is Welcome to Country. And all of our design briefs now, we begin with a recognition of the land. So that sets the stage for all participants as they're thinking about the approach that they're going to take to the design challenge. And I'd just like to reiterate what Elizabeth said and give a shout out to Matt Sundquist, the director of Fly Ranch, who's been really instrumental in making those networks and connections with the Paiute and other tribal nations of Nevada area. So thanks to him and the rest of the Fly Ranch team, who've been incredible in that regard. And then I guess lastly, I'd like to reflect on a project that is very near and dear to our hearts that we started in collaboration with the fashion designer, Taranay Mosley, who runs a project called Idiadega. She's incredible. She took it upon herself to sit with a group of Maasai women in Olorgesailie, Kenya, in the Rift Valley for weeks and weeks until they asked her, "Why are you here?" And she said that she would like to work with them, co-design works of fashion, and then she would like to take their creative work and bring it to market in Paris Fashion Week and New York Fashion Week and bring all the proceeds back and help them build a sustainable economy for themselves through that. And she has done that and continues to do that. And in 2016, I think, she reached out to us, and because she heard from the community there that they would like to have more solar power. And it was a really wonderful experience to have a 3-week long workshop directly with Olorgesailie Maasai Women Artists Collective. And we worked to co-design what solar means in their culture, how it could be manifest in a way that works with the way that they live in the land, a traditional approach, a conventional approach to energy installation is not viable. It needs to be rethought from the ground up. And that's what we did those weeks. And we're still working to bring a Maasai solar module, which is more wearable, which is more portable, to market to contribute to that sustainable economy that's developing there through what Terranay started.
And in that process, as we were doing research before we went to Olorgesailie, Kenya, we found a really interesting report, and I apologize, I don't have the name on hand, but I can send it to you, and it's on our website, that discusses the devastation that many renewable energy installations have created to the indigenous cultures in that part of the world. And again, it's case study after case study and folks telling their story of, for example, if a large-scale wind installation comes into traditionally Maasai land, people are then moved out and placed into housing that does not culturally make sense to them. One, for example.
Yeah, they're nomads. They move with their cattle.
That's exactly right. So the question is, how can we avoid, you know, renewable energy resource curse around the world and also in the United States? What we don't want to see is, without proper conversation and consultation, large pieces, parcels of land in the Navajo Nation, for example, with well-intentioned people coming in to create renewable energy landscapes, but perhaps not really having a conversation about what that might mean in that place.
I'd like to say that the Kayenta Solar Project by the Navajo Nation is actually a pretty good model of a utility scale project owned by the Navajo Nation and is sort of breaking a new mold rather than being owned by an outside entity. The Kayenta is a pretty good example, although we would love to also work to think about how those kind of resources could be distributed to more remote areas that aren't on the grid in the Navajo Nation, which is an issue right now.
Right. So are you finding that when you're working with indigenous cultures, that there's an openness to bringing this technology into the community?
Well, we really only work with communities by invitation. So if we are working with anyone anywhere in the world, it's because we've been invited in. And at that point, someone has an understanding of different ways that we've worked. And we do our best at the point that we've been invited in. We like to encourage a community process where stakeholders are invited to be a part of the conversation so that we don't move forward on any project until it's been determined by broader community what that project might look like. Mm-hmm. So we start in a participatory way that empowers community to make those decisions.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that we're really not the people to answer that question necessarily, for the reason that Elizabeth states, but we are on the outside looking in, and rural electrification is an important thing that we see as something that is desired, and it's basic needs based, like you say, although the electrification needs are modest. And when we left our time in Olorgesailie, Kenya, we really reflected on how the value structure of the global economy has been so upside down for so long, because we've used words historically like developing world and developed world and first world and third world. And these come with value judgments in the language, which we would prefer to start using words like high carbon and low carbon, because as it stands today, there are economies that are low carbon economies that we should be looking to find out how they do work and how they do function more in harmony with the planet than the high carbon economies that you and I we're all in right now, speaking Seattle. So I think we can see an opportunity to flip that value judgment in the way that we talk about indigenous cultures, especially. There's so much that the rest of the world has to learn, relearn.
Mm-hmm. Totally, I agree with you. That's wonderful. Thank you. tell us what you're working on now. You just finished the game and you have a couple other things coming up in 2021.
Yes, we just also closed Loggy 2020 Fly Ranch. So behind the scenes, no one has seen those submissions yet, 185. They are in a process of technical review. And then in January and February, they'll go through the next phases of selection process. So there's some great conversation happening behind the scenes right now about the submissions. And then we're very excited because Fly Ranch and Burning Man Project will be prototyping potentially a dozen of the submissions on site next summer. So that's what's really exciting for us, is to see these manifest in the world.
Yeah. We wrote a blog about this time last year talking about the 2020s as the decade for action. And as you know, the Land Art Generator, we're a decade old. So we started in 2010, really, with our launching of our first Open Call International Design Competition. And at that time, we were more speculative. We were imagining what could be possible in the world. And there's a lot of value in that, especially educational purposes, inspiring young people with these amazing visions of a post-carbon future. But we're so interested now in shifting to a model of deployment where it's time to start manifesting this portfolio in the world to the benefit of neighborhoods and people.
There's so many incredible prototypes and schematics on your website. It's amazing to see, and the representation from around the world and the ideas, you know, across different sectors, whether it's, you know, carbon storage or it's solar power or wind or, you know, working with water, all these different resources. And so I was thinking when I was looking through the past competitions and looking at the designs and ideas that we're in this place where we need to rapidly shift, all of us in different fields, and think about climate. And it's accelerated so much faster, I think, than some people certainly recognize and have been warning, but other people imagined. And so it's nice to see that, you know, you're able to actually start getting some of these things built.
Absolutely. The time is now. It's past time. We, you know, in terms of getting back to what you were saying about policy, really everyone's got the goalpost as a net zero 2050, but that requires getting halfway there by the end of this decade, really, if we want to be in a good position to make that goal. And that's all with the two degree target of the Paris Accord, with 1.5 as the aspiration. Probably we may have already bake that into the climate cake, as they say, so far. But so we see that it's an important thing that we have all the tools at our disposal. And while there will be a place for remote, massive utility, centralized solar and wind, other kinds of renewable energy installations, integrating them into cities and the places that we live and work creates more resilience and provides a lot of social equity opportunities, wealth building opportunities. An installed new solar panel returns at a 7% annualized rate, if all other things being equal. And so if we can start to provide opportunities to provide access to that wealth building mechanism for communities, then it can also be a tool in an equitable economy, long-term planning vision for the country. And so we really have our mindset on how, through creativity, participatory design, community engagement, we can start to see a massive transformation of our communities within cities and suburban areas to create solar-powered, wind-powered municipalities that rely less on those remote centralized infrastructures and distribution systems. And all of that comes into play with the relationships between neighborhood groups and utility companies and state regulators. And so this decade is going to be an exciting time for transitioning, setting the policy stages to make possible this incredible transformation, which is cultural, social, economic, and infrastructural.
Are you hopeful?
We are very hopeful. Everything that we're seeing from people who are studying this very closely, the social and cultural aspects of the energy transition, gives us a lot of hope, because some of those people are in positions to influence the policies that are being made. And so yes, we're very hopeful.
Also hopeful because we see so many young people really rallying for this cause. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the greatest sense of hope. You know, it's harder to change the minds of our elders, I think. But if we can educate young people to honor the land and understand what sustainability is and move forward, they're at the helm soon. They'll be making the policy decisions.
Yeah.
So I feel very hopeful.
You are both so inspiring. You have done so much to create this synergy of new ideas. So what inspires you? What are you reading?
This year, in the year of Black Lives Matter and coronavirus, we've been doing a lot of reading about racial justice and social equity and thinking a lot about alternative models that can enhance democracy. One of the books that I read in quarantine that was really inspiring to me was This Life by Martin Hagelin. So I'll give that a shout out. And I think specifically around the utility space, Leia Stokes' short-circuiting policy is a good reference. And another thing that gives us hope, because the way that the electric utilities have been designed piecemeal over a century or more has led to this really weird structure. And the regulatory framework is just in desperate need of updating. And there are a lot of good thinkers out there like her who are working hard on establishing a regulatory environment that can be, instead of swimming upstream, we can be going with the current towards a sustainable infrastructure for this country. So that also gives us hope.
The MAP Radio Hour is produced by Make Art with Purpose and edited by Matthew Horton. Theme song by Jan Vorpas. Logo by Otto Huditz. I'm Janiel Engelstad. Thanks for listening, and visit makeartwithpurpose.net to learn more about our projects and connect with us on social media.